This is Our Prisons, The Answer,
a monthly show on Justice Radio with your hosts, Catherine Besteman and Leo Hilton. This show explores how we keep our communities safe and asks the question, are prisons the answer? I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College.
I'm Leo Hilton, and I come to the show not only as someone with lived experience in the criminal legal system, but also as a co-instructor with Catherine at Colby College and a restorative justice scholar practitioner of 6 years.
Today, we're talking with Reverend Jane Field, the Executive Director of the Maine Council of Churches. Specifically, we're going to explore why the Maine Council of Churches strongly supports LD 178, the parole bill that's currently being considered by Maine lawmakers. In your testimony, you quote passages from the Hebrew and Christian scriptures about prisoners. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about those passages and how you interpret those passages from ancient texts within the context of our current world.
The strongest one that just leaps to the front of my mind as a Christian is when Jesus was trying to get through the thick heads of his followers, and our heads are no less thick today, where we should look when we're looking for him. It's in the face of people who are oppressed, who are marginalized, who are outcasts, and he specifically mentions people in prison. It's that famous passage in Matthew 25, when did we see you? You saw me when you did this for the least of these, my brothers and sisters. And one of the examples he gives is, you came and visited me in prison. But that isn't the only place that prisons and prisoners are mentioned in both Hebrew and Christian scripture. In fact, the first sermon Jesus ever preached, he referred to the prophet Isaiah in saying, I've been anointed to preach release to captives, to set the prisoners free. It was one of the very first things he said about why he was there, what his work and sense of calling was about. So it was central to his self-understanding. And then in the letters that circulated around in the early church, for example, in Hebrews, which is part of what some people call the New Testament, people are admonished who are part of Christian community, remember people who are in prison as if you were there with them. So it's that love of neighbor embodied, you know, empathy taken to the extent of imagine and think of them as if you were there too. So those were the scriptures that felt relevant to me the day that I sat down to write and imagine what I'd want to say to the legislators on that committee.
What parole models is what we would hope we could model within our communities, both inside prisons and outside prisons and across those prison walls. And so is it a challenge for some folks to actually take to heart those deeply profound concepts? We're wondering, what's your thinking on that?
I do think it's hard. And I think one of the major reasons it's hard is fear. The one thing in both Hebrew and Christian scripture, if you add it all up, the thing God says to people more than anything else is don't be afraid. So that tells me that's a fairly important message we're supposed to get. And yet we never do, because we almost have that default reptile brain setting of I should be afraid. Out of fear comes the need to punish. Out of fear comes wariness about difference. Out of fear comes the unwillingness to risk hope that true rehabilitation or restoration could happen. In some ways, I think fear is one of the biggest obstacles and probably one of the biggest sources of pushback. Another more practical thing that I've heard and heard that day at the legislature is that Department of Corrections says things like, but we already have ways for people to get out early, which is so not the whole story. The community release program is only in the last 30 months of your sentence. So if you have a really long sentence, that's not the same thing as parole at all. Yes, there's parole. And I think, what is there, one person still left that was convicted 76 that would be affected by this? Like, that's not realistic. And then time off for good behavior is unsupervised. You're just set loose. And that's not fair to the community. It's not fair to the formerly incarcerated person either, as far as I'm concerned. I do not have lived experience as having been incarcerated, although I've taught in prisons. So I need to be careful that I don't talk about something I don't know firsthand. But to not have any support and any structure and to just be let loose, statistics show your recidivism rate is much higher than if you're in a parole program where there's supervision. So for the Department of Corrections here in Maine to say we don't need parole because we already have these other things, that's not a reasonable argument. You know, another bill that we're active on is, well, we were hoping it would be a ban on solitary confinement. Instead, it's going to be a study commission to look at uses of solitary confinement. But those same folks in uniforms who have lots of authority to people who don't know any better will say, we don't do it anymore here. And that's just not true. They just call it something else. Yeah, we have those other programs, but they're not parole, and they wouldn't do the same thing that parole would do.
Thank you so much for that. Jane Field, Executive Director of the Maine Council of Churches.
This is From Our Perspective, Voices of the Directly Impacted, a monthly show from Justice Radio here on WMPG with your host, Marian Anderson. Today, we're talking with a very special guest, Kayla Kalel. Kayla is a formerly incarcerated woman from Maine, a passionate advocate for people who use drugs and people who are seeking recovery. Kayla is also the co-creator of and co-founder of the Birth Justice Collective.
I'm so glad to be here and be part of this conversation. So I'm Kayla, and I'm a person in recovery and a person that previously used drugs. And like you said, a person that was previously incarcerated. I also provide doula services. So I work with folks prenatal, birthing, or postpartum, and particularly with groups of people that statistically don't have access to doula services. So with a couple of my dear friends that are also doulas in the state, we created the Birth Justice Collective. And a big reason for that was, like, even in the year 2022, we still see health disparities with certain groups of people, right? So, like, Black birthing folks still to this day experience higher rates of mortality during childbirth than their white counterpart.
Today's show is really about, like, cycles of harm, right? And punishment that we use so widely in our society, you know, through the prison industrial complex, jails and prisons, and how that system really perpetuates those cycles. So I want to first talk about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. A lot of folks don't know what that is, but essentially it's a series of questions that can determine a person's outcome in life, right? And if you're scoring high on an ACEs test, there's a likelihood that you will have substance use disorder or that you will end up in jail or prison. So I'd like to hear from you about your experiences with that and the things that you've witnessed in your work.
Yeah. So the first thing that comes to mind is just, like, the simple fact that one of the ACE questions, like one of the markers for having an increased chance for having substance use disorder or having criminal justice involvement is, have you had a parent or do you have a parent that is currently incarcerated? So, like, right off the bat, like, we are already, you know, like you said, we're creating the next generation of broken people when we, you know, are punishing moms, quote unquote, but also, like, ensuring that that newborn baby doesn't have their, you know, gestational parent. And there's, like, all kinds of studies around the fact that, like, we know that children that don't have access to their, you know, birthing parents within the first 2 weeks of life cannot achieve, like, proper brain development. I mean, that blows my mind. And, like, we know all of these things, right, within our systems, and yet we still do things that we know create harm. And, like, that's just wild to me. There's actually a TED Talk by a doctor called Gabor Maté, and he talks about how he was born in Budapest, Hungary in 1944 into a Jewish family, and he, like, cried for, like, the first, like, 2 months of his life, and his mom couldn't figure out why. And when she called the pediatrician said, you know, I can come see him, but every Jewish baby that I'm, like, seeing, you know, is crying. And it wasn't because, like, you know, Jewish newborns were experts in genocide, right? Or, like, they knew anything about war. It was because their moms and dads were walking around with, like, you know, increased fear and, like, worry that, you know, their homes were going to be ripped open by soldiers, you know? So that just speaks to, like, how connected we are with our children. And when we incarcerate moms, we incarcerate entire families, essentially, you know, and really entire communities.
Yeah, it is crazy. You know, it's fascinating. I appreciate you sharing that story. You know, we don't realize the impact or the connection that exists between a gestational parent and their child. And you're right. We know these things are harmful, right? We have the evidence. We've got the science. We've got the facts. And yet we continue to do these things. We practice these ways of perpetuating cycles of harm that just carry over generationally.
I was just going to say, like, after I was in prison, I was asked to speak on a bill that was specific to ensuring that the Department of Corrections, like, required a higher like standard of care for people that were pregnant and trying to breastfeed. And it was so crazy to me because the lady that runs the prison ended up coming to that legislative session and standing up and, like, insisting that that was the standard of care that they were already giving folks. And so she said that, you know, the bill shouldn't be passed. And then she actually stood up previous to anyone speaking and asked the like the folks that were voting on the bill, if she could speak first, because she said there's like 8 or 9 women in here that were incarcerated like under my care. And she's like, it would be too hard for me to hear their stories. And like, you know, it'd be emotional. And like, for me, that's like, if we have like a system where the person that's like, you know, running the entire system can't look us in the eye and hear our experiences, like that system is very, very, very disrupted.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Kayla. It was wonderful having you on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Marian. I really appreciate you offering the space. This is so important. I mean, it's imperative.
This is Creating Windows, Not Bars, a monthly show on Justice Radio on WMPG with your hosts, Mackenzie Kelly and Linda Small.
First, a little information about us. I'm Mackenzie Kelly, a recovery coach and peer mentor coordinator of Healthy Acadia and the program director of Reentry Sisters.
And I'm Linda Small, a project coordinator with Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition and executive director of Reentry Sisters, an organization with a trauma-informed and gender-responsive approach to reentry.
Today, we're talking about bringing public awareness to the widespread use of solitary confinement in the United States. What is solitary confinement, and what are the impacts on individuals, families, and our communities?
Today, we're talking with Val Cabala, the managing editor of Solitary Watch, about the use of solitary confinement in the United States and its repercussions.
I know you had said that previously when you kind of got into this work that you started reading letters from solitary confinement, right? Could you maybe tell us a little bit about like what that felt like?
It was shocking to me because reading those letters made me realize that there's a whole world existing in this country that if you don't seek it out, or if you don't know someone who's in there, or if you haven't been in there yourself, you could live your whole life and not know that people are being tortured. And we put out a report recently based on statistics from the Bureau of Justice Statistics that estimated it's about 122,000 people in this country who are in solitary confinement. And so it blew my mind. I was like, how did I not really know about this? Some of the letters that I'm visualizing, it's like people lose their minds. And so some people will write us gibberish. And some of it makes sense. And then some of it is just like a drawing. And then it's like scribble around a page. But it's like, I understand what they're saying. And sometimes and I can just tell that it's like this person is going in circles in their mind because they can't do anything else, really. Those letters definitely hit me. And then letters of people describing what they wanted to do to themselves, people who wanted to self-harm or take their own lives. Those were definitely hard to read because I'm in a position where I can't necessarily do anything besides write them back. And sometimes that can make a difference if someone actually gets a letter back instead of just writing a million people and not hearing from anyone. What also hit me was the brilliance of writers in solitary confinement, the way that they would express. Sometimes they wouldn't even be submitting a piece for publication. They were just expressing themselves. And I was like, oh my God, this person's like a genius writer. And then, you know, we would ask to publish their work. But it's so much talent, so much value, so much beauty in the people that the system is just trying to throw away. That's how I kind of see solitary confinement, prison in general, but especially solitary confinement. It's just like, you have no value, so we're going to stick you in a corner and not let you talk to anybody, not let anyone talk to you, not give you any resources, not pour into you in any way, just take everything from you and hope that you disappear. So, you know, our work tries to flip that.
Did you ever engage with women who were pregnant or mothers who were in solitary confinement? Because there's sort of a unique type of destruction, right, of motherhood within solitary confinement practices.
Yes, there is. And that's not talked about enough. There's a woman that I really look up to who actually just got out of solitary last week. She's in Texas. And she's really focused on getting the voices of women and the experiences of women in solitary out and into the conversation. Her name is Quanetta Harris, and she's a really prolific writer and also a recipient of our Ridgeway Reporting Project Award. But she talks about being a mother in solitary, and that was really devastating to read. It was in a piece that she wrote for Lux magazine, and she was saying that out of all the effects that solitary confinement had on her, which are so dire in themselves, like in her physical body and psychologically, the worst was not being able to talk to her kids. And she was in a situation where she couldn't have the phone for extended periods of time. At one point, the only way that she could have a conversation was in a guard's office with the guard right there. If her family member or her were to say something that the guard didn't like, they would just hang up. And so they were always like, you know, talking real fast, trying to fit in all the updates. And I think it was one time, like, her kid asked her if she could send her money, and the guard hung up because he was like, no, you can't talk about money. It's just so cruel. I just can't imagine being a mother and not having that ability to know if your kids are okay. You just don't know. Like, you're existing in this reality where something could have happened and you don't know, and you don't have any way to find out. The woman I read about, her name was Pamela Nguyen, and she told her story about how she actually ended up miscarrying because they would force her to be cuffed behind her back whenever they would move her, which is typical in solitary confinement. Whenever you leave your cell, you have to be cuffed off, and you have to be strip searched every time you leave your cell, even for visits, even for legal visits. And so they were enforcing that on her. She was forced to be cuffed behind her back. And one time she fell and she, you know, miscarried.
Thank you so much, Val, for sharing the incredible work of Solitary Watchdog Org with us.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Ending the Drug War in Maine. This is Charlotte Warren, and I am here with my pal, Zoe Brokus, who's the executive director of the Church of Safe Injection. Zoe, I think our listeners probably would really like to know, why are you and I so thankful that harm reduction funding, right, is coming through? Why does this matter? What do SSPs do? What does it mean? And why should we all continue to make sure that this is supported?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important because historically, it's been incredibly difficult to get state and federal, not just funding, but like acceptance of the work. It's a hard one for people. You know, people really put drug use in this basket of like moral failure, right? Like, well, you made a choice, you made a decision, you started using drugs. And so why should I have to pay for that? Why should I have to be involved in that? And it's like, okay, sure, fine. I think that we've made some progress over the years. I hear less of that now. I really do. I think people are starting to understand. And so we're starting to really see this shift away from kind of denouncing it entirely. And I do just have to share this new definition of harm reduction that we found this week that is so incredibly beautiful. It comes from the Faith and Harm Reduction website. You know, harm reduction values rooted in faith. And this is what it has to say. Harm reduction is holy, faithful resistance rooted in love and unapologetically insistent on justice. It is the expression of radical welcome and welcoming of all stories and paths. Harm reduction calls people by name and attends to and cherishes the particularities. It is a hospitality that seeks people out, meets them where they are, and invites them into loving community. There's more, but like, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever read. And I think that that is what we try to create every day in our, certainly in our syringe service program, SSP at COSI. And we do that in a couple of different ways. You know, there are the reasons why people come into our program, right? Which is access to clean supplies and a place to safely dispose of their used supplies. And so when we talk about supplies, we're primarily talking about syringes. A lot of people who use drugs by injection. That injection technique is typically a diabetic syringe. And while people absolutely can become dependent on the substance that they're using, like opioids, people also can become very dependent on the ritual of the process. And so with injecting, there is a whole process for how that happens. And at every step of that process, there is risk for infection and risk for possible transmission of diseases like HIV and hepatitis. And so that's where our programming even began way back in the 80s, right? It was an HIV AIDS prevention technique and has since really evolved. Here in Maine, we're a very low incidence state for HIV, but we have skyrocketing levels of hepatitis, primarily hepatitis A, B, and C. Hepatitis C is primarily transmitted through blood, and one of the main risk factors is injection drug use, shared equipment. And so programs like ours, you know, that's like the pragmatic, practical reason why people come in, because syringes aren't that easy to purchase, right? Like, you can go to a pharmacy in Maine, it's at the pharmacist's discretion whether or not they will sell somebody syringes. I could certainly go in and buy syringes, right? Like, probably no problem. But some of our participants, some of our friends who maybe are unhoused, probably will not be able to access syringes at a pharmacy. With funding, we're able to provide all of the supplies and services that we offer for free. And so we offer every piece of equipment that is recommended for the safest and cleanest injection event that somebody is willing and able to engage in. And then there's everything else. There's naloxone, there's snacks, there's a warm place to hang out, coffee. And then there's just like conversation with other community members, with our staff, who will often be really skilled in offering some suggestions, offering education. We really encourage all of our staff to receive training in motivational interviewing. They're all certified intentional peer support professionals and recovery coaches. And so they really have those skills.
Thank you, Zoe, for sharing that with us. And thanks for all the work you and your team are doing.
This is Justice Radio. This episode is the first in a three-part series about surviving harm and the relationship between accountability, healing, and justice in relation to our criminal legal system. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College and the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative.
And I'm Linda Small, Executive Director of Reentry Sisters, an organization that supports restorative reentry for women returning from prison. Today, our guest is Aswad Thomas, the Vice President of the Alliance for Safety and Justice and the National Director of Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice. Welcome, Aswad, and thank you so much for joining us.
We think our listeners would be really interested to hear your own story. What brought you to this work?
Great question. What brought me to this work is my family's experience and my own personal experience with victimization and also incarceration as well. So I grew up, I was born in Hartford, Connecticut, but I spent the majority of my childhood living in Detroit, Michigan. You know, growing up as the youngest son, I watched, you know, my three older brothers and, you know, all of the majority of the young Black men in my community, you know, walk a path to destruction. And for me, my first experience with violence was in 1993. My best friend, Reuben Elder, was shot and killed in a drive-by shooting when he was only 10 years old. You know, we didn't have any grief counselors at our school. You know, our community didn't have any services to help us as children and Reuben's family to deal with that loss. And our parents didn't know how to talk about it, of how to, you know, deal with this tragic shooting. So the community kind of just, you know, went on without dealing with that trauma that we all had experienced as children. In 2009, I became the first male in my family to ever graduate from college. I was also a star college basketball player at Elms College in Massachusetts. So 2009 for me, it was like the highest point of my life. I had just graduated from college, had signed with a professional basketball agent to start my professional basketball career in Europe. Just 3 weeks before I was supposed to go to Europe, I became a victim of gun violence. I was shot twice in my back while leaving a convenience store in my neighborhood. And I remember, you know, after a few days of that shooting, you know, I was discharged from that hospital back into the same community where I was shot. And for me, that was a very traumatic experience in dealing with the PTSD, the flashbacks, the nightmares, the anxiety, the stress, psychological effects of being a victim of gun violence, which nobody told me about. You know, I remember my doctor and my nurses, you know, talking about the physical challenges that I have, but they never mentioned the psychological effects of being a victim of a violent crime. So my recovery was in my living room, recovering from these two gunshot wounds to my back with little to no support. And during this time, the law enforcement came to visit me several times. And each time it was always about the case. They never asked me how I was doing. They never told me about where to go to get victim services. They never informed me about the victim compensation program, which was designed to help with victims like myself. And they never actually connected me to their victim advocate who's supposed to work with victims. And so, you know, as I was recovering, I began to see that the justice system wasn't focused on my healing and recovery. And so I started to think about, you know, am I the only person that went through this, of being a victim of a violent crime and not getting connected to any services or resources to help me heal from that? And so that started me on this journey of talking with my family and talking to the parents of my friends who've lost their lives to gun violence and asking them that same question. After you became a victim, did you receive any help? And 90% of the families and individuals that I talked to in my community did not receive any support. But what changed my life was during my last doctor's appointment, you know, as I was, you know, getting a surgery to remove the bullets out of my back, my doctor, you know, as he's operating on me, started to tell me this story of another young man whose life he had saved 4 years before I was shot. This young man, as my doctor described, was 14 years old. He was shot in his face. And as a result of that shooting, he had lost sight in his left eye. And as I'm listening, my heart just started to beat faster and faster. I was realizing that he was describing one of the young men that had shot me. And I remember telling my doctor, I said, you know, Dr. Marshall, the person who you just described, that whose life you saved 4 years prior, that's one of the young men that had shot me. And right there, I remember my doctor saying, this is how the cycle of violence continues. That just like you, we discharged you with no support and help. And 4 years ago, we discharged that young man with no support and help. That unaddressed trauma played a huge role with me getting shot years later. So right then, I decided to turn my pain and heal from that shooting, but also become an advocate and organizer.
Thank you, Aswad. I'll just reiterate your point about a new victims' rights movement that's synonymous with healing, by which you mean healing for everybody. So thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, and to Luke Brown and Aaron Pyle, our sound engineers, we are Justice Radio.